Hello, everybody. I'm George from Ireland, and here is this book, No Other Choice by George Blake. Fascinatingly, it was a library book withdrawn from circulation, and it was in, I think, the College of Mary Immaculate in Limerick. Colosta, Edenquis, Vira, Gan, and I can't read the rest of it, Loimeanach. That's Irish language for Irish. Okay. Published by Jonathan Cape in 1990. So George Blake is best known as one of the Cambridge spies, but I don't want to retell the whole sordid tale. Anyhow, so this book is mostly got pace. I wouldn't say it's unputdownable. Parts of it are engrossing. In places, the narrative is pedestrian, is analytical in places. So yes, it's an autobiography. It's an apologia. There he is, Mr. Blake, born George Bahar in 1922 in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. So there he was in Moscow, wearing probably some Britannic clothes. There he was. It doesn't really look like him, this one, the Royal Naval Cadet. And there he is as an officer. Okay. So joined the Royal Navy, commissioned as an officer quite quickly. I think intelligence, because of what he would do in the Netherlands. There he is as a child in the Netherlands, going to Egypt, look, wearing a tarbush, well, call it fez in Egypt with a bicycle. Stayed with relatives in the 1930s in Cahire. And there he is as a hostage in North Korea, because there were no respecters of diplomatic immunity. Having said that, I suppose the United Kingdom didn't recognize the People's Democratic Republic of Korea. That's North Korea in plain English. And with his children in Lebanon, was posted with the Foreign Office, MI6. And then his mother, to whom he was incredibly close, who lived almost the age of 100, as he did himself. Okay. And there he has this jovial scene of serenity in an English country garden the year before he was apprehended for his espionage activities. And then his second wife. So he had three children, three sons with his first wife, one with his second, three children with his first wife, one child, one son with his second wife. And there he is in the Soviet Union. So mostly bearded most of his life. And he just died in COVID. This is 30 years before his death. Died at the age of 98. So it tells the tale of his upbringing, somewhat emotional in places. It's fairly descriptive. He's obviously a highly intelligent man, and he can lay bare a person in just a few pithy sentences. Has a little bit of dialogue, which is obviously recalled from memory decades later, and tells us his inmost thoughts, his gift for dissembling, his political evolution. He went on this odyssey from being a zealous Calvinist with a possibly small c conservative leanings to losing the faith, to obviously being a Dutch patriot, then a British patriot. There seemed to be no contradiction between that, as relations very cordial in the mid-20th century. And then when he was in MI6, being a Cold Warrior, not being ideologically committed to it, but I mean, not opposed either, as he had some residual Christian faith. He was obviously cognizant that Christianity was viciously persecuted by communists. This is the time of Stalin, when a religious observance was enough to land you in a slave labor camp. Admittedly, that was loosened up in 1941 and tightened up again after 1945 and severely tightened actually under Khrushchev in the early 60s. Ironically, which is just when Blake got caught. The tipping point came when he was in Korea. So when North Korea invades, he had the British legation in Seoul told to stay put, thinking the United Kingdom would be neutral, but it wasn't, thinking at least their diplomatic status would be respected, but it wasn't, and they were simply taken hostage, held in North Korea, surprisingly not taken to China or even to the Soviet Union, where there'd be no chance they'd escape. But eventually, that's when he begins to think, am I on the wrong side? And he said it was seeing these American flying fortresses bombing these little villages. Now, a lot of people always get killed in war, civilians always get killed. Remember, the mid-20th century technology was very primitive. There were no guided missiles back then. But sometimes there just was no military rationale for bombing this. This is just a village of like mud huts. There are no military assets, there are no military personnel around there. There's no need to bomb them. So some of these people are vicious, or they overzealous, think, well, there might be enemy fighters in this house. Well, there might be. But there's no proof, or there's no even evidence suggestive. They're just doing it anyway. So, of course, there's some psychopathic killers in the Air Force, and there's just death at a distance. It just seems unreal. Seems like a game. bombing on these people who suddenly seem like as tiny as ants so far below you. They're just so divorced from the reality of it. And he said that that's what made him flip. But wait a second, obviously the Soviets were doing that as well, like in the 1920s, where they're bombing places in Central Asia and so forth to conquer Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, and the rest, and obviously doing it in Afghanistan in the 1980s. So it was a really irrational, hypocritical argument. And he correctly said he noticed how corrupt Syngman Rhee's dictatorship was. Okay, so that's when he changed his side ideologically and tell the Soviets he's on their side. But he was obviously good at being taciturn beforehand, cloak and dagger in the Netherlands when he was in the Dutch resistance as a courier, as a teenager, just below military age, and managed to get himself from the Netherlands to Spain. Now, these days, you just jump on EasyJet or whatever, or even a long distance coach. But the Second World War was no easy task. There were all sorts of, frontier posts and roadblocks and documents checks. And he was a British citizen, but I don't know if he got, can't remember if he got himself false papers. But anyway, he managed to do it and get to the UK, and that was it. So he was inducted into MI6 shortly after the Second World War, spending a year at Cambridge University, Downing College. He's actually not one of the Cambridge Five, which is Anthony Blunt, Guy Burgess, Kim Philby, Donald MacLean, and John Cairncross. They were all in Cambridge in the late 20s, early 1930s. He only went to Cambridge in about 1947. 1 year there to hone his Russian language skills. So obviously he was a polyglot, a very brainy man, though he never took a degree. So 1 year Russian language course. Within 2 months, he was able to read Russian novels, admittedly with the aid of a dictionary. So it's about what was going on, his personal lives, his wife and so on. And he's a shrewd observer of the class system, of social mores and prejudices. He's very cosmopolitan because his father was a Turkish Jew who was in the French Foreign Legion and the British Army, acquired British nationality, which he passed on to his son, born in Rotterdam, itself a very international city. This is a major trading port, to this day a big entrepot for those sea containers. One of the biggest ports in the world, and his mother is an indigenous Dutch woman. So he's got, where is he related to? Turkey, the Netherlands, the United Kingdom, had cousins in Egypt he went to stay with in the 1930s for a while. And then Henri Curiel, his cousin about 10 years older than him, became a leading light in the French Communist Party, gunned down by right-wing terrorists in 1978. So what else about Blake? And then, obviously, in the United Kingdom, the British Empire was still extant. When he was in Korea, he managed to learn some of the Korean language, blah, blah, blah. So, obviously, learned Dutch and English at home, German at school, French at school, Latin at school, Korean later, and Russian. So, 7 languages, won prizes for Latin at school, and so forth. But this, I would recommend it to you because it's a journey through the Cold War. Are there any lies in it? I didn't contain any falsehoods. And then he was apprehended in 1961 by largely circumstantial evidence. How they interrogated him, probably his mistake was not to flee, because I don't think they had any legal grounds. Well, they were questioning him. It wasn't an arrest. They had no legal grounds to prevent him from leaving the country. Just jump on a flight, go to Berlin, walk into the Soviet sector, and he'd be free. But they appealed to his pride and accused him of turning over this information for douceur, which he hadn't, because he'd been released from Korea in 1953. He came back to the United Kingdom. And he met his Soviet handler and so on. And then he began revealing the identities of Western agents in the communist bloc. He said, with the proviso that none of them would be put to death. And as Oleg Kalugin, a very senior figure in the KGB first directorate, later said that he was naive, well, he's willfully blind. Of course, they were executed, most of them. And who on earth would trust the KGB? Blake, you can say many, many things about Blake, traitorous, evil, but he wasn't thick. He must have known they were going to break his word to him. But I suppose, yeah, he just chose to close his mind to that. And this is proves the moral superiority of the free world in the Cold War, that he never alleges he was tortured. And they did it very nicely over a long weekend. And then he got 42 years, considering he'd betrayed, in his own, by his own estimation, 400 agents. If he'd led to the death of even one of those, you might regard that as murder. He got a 42-year sentence. Under the Official Secrets Act, 14 years was the maximum, but I think they said we did it thrice. We did it more than that, really. And then two peacenicks busted out of jail with the help of Sean Burke, an Irishman, Sean Burke from Limerick, who was later murdered by the KGB in Kilkee, County Clare. Oleg Kalugin recounts this in his memoirs. So it's quite self-justifying. He appears to be a man of immense fortitude. As people said, the idea of a 42-year sentence, he took that in his stride and determined to get the best out of prison. But he was empathetic and he realized he's put his wife through the ringer, and the way that she didn't hate him and his sons came round him at the end is a testament to their magnanimity. And then astonishingly managing to escape from Wormwood Scrubs prison with the help of those two and Sean Burke, be hid in a flat in London for 3 months and then smuggled in a camper van sort of under the floorboards all the way to East Berlin. So that was it, living in relative luxury in the Soviet Union the rest of his life. And obviously accorded a hero's welcome there. But by 1990, it was glasnost, so he could reflect quite candidly on the shortcomings of the Soviet system and how communism, and his own words, was a failure. But he glosses over the massive scale state terrorism of the Soviet Union, the genocide against the Kazakhs, the Ukrainians, in other words, the mass enslavement of alleged political dissidents, the lack of any freedom of expression, of any fair trial, of any rights of people, of security of person, of the right to form a trade union, to strike, to demonstrate, to even move freely within the country, to emigrate, and the relative lack of religious liberty. And the Russian Orthodox Church existed only if the priests were informants for the KGB, which they were. So that was Blake living out a comfortable retirement. No comfortable retirement for his many, many victims. There's 400 people whom he may well have sent to the firing squad. So he has no conscience in that sense, but he was a tranquil, affable, intelligent man, a gifted man who chose to serve an evil cause. And I'm not purblind. I recognize there's lots of wickedry on the Western side as well. And there were atrocities committed by the United States in Vietnam and elsewhere, or, you know, fighting to uphold the Britannic Empire in East Africa. That was a righteous cause. But some of the methods we used were unrighteous. And people were tortured in Kenya, and some people were even castrated in Kenya, which is truly horrifying. So I realize it's not that the moral balance is not completely one-sided. But, you know, he was serving the Soviet Union under its cruelest era, under Stalin. And how did he that square with his supposed moral principles? And some of his critique of capitalism, though, is valid. So it's an enthralling read in most places. And he says, to all intents and purposes, he's bilingual, where he definitely is. So his command of it, the English language, is not to be questioned. So there's a clarity to the prose, sometimes sprightly. Weaknesses, yeah, I mean, it slows down too much. It dwells on some unimportant or uninteresting chapters. I suppose more dialogue would enliven it, but he's quite truthful in places. As I say, I don't think there's a single falsehood he told, but that these maybe are lies of omission. The selectivity of what he's included in his autobiography is notable. No other choice. Well, that's a lie to begin with. There was another choice. He could have remained faithful to the oath that he'd taken voluntarily. And you've got to ask, when Soviets were caught doing what he did, a fraction of what he did, they would be executed like that after being horrifically tortured and their families had been severely punished, not sent to the Gulag, not by 1961, but they would have been demoted, sent to some small city, would never be able to access tertiary education, and. So that is George Blake. So yes, I recommend this one, part of my ongoing fascination with this tournament of shadows well into the Holodnaya Vayna. Goodbye, everyone.